With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, this is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord and you're listening to The Legacy Tapes, a series of conversations with artistic leaders talking about ideas around legacy and what it means to try and leave something behind in a largely ephemeral medium. And I'm here with Vicky Featherston, who is the Artistic Director at the Royal Court. Before that, she was the founding Artistic Director at the National Theatre of Scotland. She ran Payne's Plough, she's edited brilliant TV programmes. Basically, she's kind of an icon. Which is probably something that you hate hearing or love hearing?
Never heard it before, so...
Oh, great! So, oh, hi!
I've never heard it before. And I do hate it, but that's...
You do, I hate it, I'm sorry. Well, I just think, because kind of for, especially for women, for female directors of my generation, and I hate defining people just as women, because that's not what we are, we're other things, but it's so brilliant to be able to see somebody there doing it and be like, okay, it's possible. I can do that. That even if that's something, I mean, I feel like that's probably one of your legacies, even if you're not consciously striving for it. So what was it like? Let's just jump straight in. What, when you took over here?
Yeah.
Because it's such a contrast from starting National Theatre of Scotland, yeah, because you can kind of make that in your own image, but yeah, here it has that weight of years.
Legacy.
Were you aware of that? Were you aware of kind of...
I think, obviously, I'm aware of it because the Royal Court, since I went to university when I was 18, has always been sort of part of my sort of theatre conversation, if you like. I went to Manchester University, and the plays that I read, the British plays that I read, that were the ones that suddenly kind of clicked with me the most, were the plays that, coincidentally, I thought had got first performed at the Royal Court in the front of them. Mm-hmm. So they were the plays that really kind of switched me on to kind of theatre being about now and not being a kind of respectful look into the past, which is ironic when we're talking about legacy, of course.
Yeah.
So I've always kind of looked to the Royal Court in a way. I feel that when I got this job, however, I was naive to the power of that legacy to the artistic director. Mm-hmm. Because for me, the job at the Royal Court, in one sense, is about who are the new voices, what are the stories that we need to be telling now, what are the forms that we need to be discovering, who are the people that we need to be encouraging, how are we moving theatre forwards for the future. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the primary role of the artistic director of the Royal Court. But of course, you also have to nurture the past, because we are standing on the shoulders of giants. Mm-hmm. Somebody said this phrase, you know, the National Theatre of Scotland, it's really a brilliant phrase, I think, standing on the shoulders of giants. Mm-hmm. And actually, that must be acknowledged, and the best bits from that to be learned from, and the not great bits to be rejected.
Yeah.
So there's an interesting balance, but I've never felt the pressure of the past at the Royal Court, but yeah.
That's exactly what you want to hear in a lot of ways, because I think I would be so worried taking up the post in a place with such a history that I would I'd do something stupid like be scared of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the benefit that I had was that actually, although it probably doesn't feel like this now or to the majority of people in the outside world, I was quite an outsider to this role. A lot of the people who've taken the sort of mantle of artistic director at the Royal Court have had a much more fundamental relationship with it in terms of they've either been associate directors or they've been assistant directors here and they've worked a lot more. Mm-hmm. I really hadn't had that much of a kind of professional kind of relationship with the Royal Court through Payne's Plough being kind of a separate thing and then National Theatre of Scotland. So I felt that I was able to, well, I didn't feel this, I wasn't aware of this at the time, but looking back, I was able to come in with the sort of things that I'd learnt from the National Theatre of Scotland and from Payne's Plough at the kind of forefront of what I wanted the Royal Court to be. Mm. And I think in the past, other people have taken it over with the thing at the forefront being the legacy that they've witnessed.
Yeah.
So what happened to me was that since I've been here, I've come to respect and love the legacy more than I thought I would, because really, I hate looking backwards and I'm quite change obsessed.
Yeah.
So I have come to kind of really enjoy it. You know, the fact that this is the first place that Brecht was ever on, you know, and it's Arthur Miller was
bloody
ever
amazing.
On, all those things, I feel incredibly proud to be here, but no pressure.
Good. No pressure. No pressure at all.
Pressure is the future.
So that's really interesting, because one of my questions was going to be like how you think about whether you think about innovation and change as a driver or kind of stability as a driver. Because I used to run a Oval House in South London, and I was really aware of what the legacy of that place was, but also this incredible need for change and relevance, and while simultaneously not burning it down.
Yes.
How do you balance those things? And actually, let's talk about NTS a little bit, because I mean, there was nothing there to protect. You had to create it.
I mean, I think going to your just really interesting kind of break, we'll come back to NTS in a minute, but the thing about stability and versus change, I think, you know, to be an artistic director, you have to be able to carry those two things. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think stability is the thing that you have to take for granted, and that you have to expect that you have to create or expect that you are running or inheriting an organisation that has the ability to be stable at its core in terms of the planning, financial resource, all of those kind of things, and that you work really hard to preserve and nurture that in order that it is all about innovation and risk. And I feel at my most fearful when we are not taking risks. Mm-hmm. I feel at my most fearful in anything that I've ever done when I feel like we're being safe in some way. And I think that's when something's going to come and hit us in the head and it's all going to go wrong. So I'm really looking for that thing. As long as if we feel we know how to do something, it feels like it's going to head towards mediocrity and isn't relevant, and why should we be spending public money on doing it? It's actually about subsidies here for us to be able to do things that we don't know how to do, that writers don't know how to write, that we don't know whether they're going to work. And what you bring, hopefully, the legacy that I hope I have for myself in this is that I hope that my experience enables that to be within a secure enough environment that I'm not going to fuck up the report. Yeah. So it's those two balances. But at NTS, what was very interesting was, of course, that the sort of history of theatre in Scotland is so entirely different to the history of theatre in England that the notion of what a sort of canon is and what the sort of legacy of theatre handing forward is a very, very different sense of pressures. So there wasn't, when I started, one cohesive idea about what the history of theatre is in Scotland, because it's never really been a kind of clear narrative, because it's been so sort of broken up. Whereas here, we do all agree, regardless of where we stand now, on what the kind of history of theatre in this country is. Shakespeare, you know, the court supporting West, blah 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 blah.
There's an agreed narrative.
There is an absolute agreed narrative. So it's very interesting starting an organisation where there isn't even an agreed narrative about what the history of theatre is and where we're at. Which can be quite explosive in a way, because of course the version that I spoke about around what that was the fact that there wasn't a Scottish theatre canon, and that I was at liberty to be able to be part of creating one for now and looking at what a national theatre meant now. It wasn't about having to take responsibility for putting all of those old plays on and preserving them in some way. Now, of course, some people would then say to me, the older generation would sort of say, but there are these plays, these plays, these plays, these plays. And, of course, they're not wrong. But compared to what the weight of that theatre canon is in England, it's not a big pressure. What happened in Scotland, which was fascinating, was that the kind of theatre shifted, really, mainly around John McGraw and A Good Night Out, and then Achieve It and Stag and the Black Black Oil. So the theatre history was a recent theatre history. It was a demotic history. It was one about telling the political stories of now, using song, using story, taking it to the people, and sort of blasting through a kind of elite theatre form.
Hey, and as a manifesto, that's pretty awesome.
There we go. So for me, that was an amazing legacy to be able to look back to and to aspire to be, to create the modern, the new version of that with the resource and with the Brecht National. So that was really exciting.
I mean, it must have been. Yeah, it sounds, when you put it like that, when you look at that as the what you're working with, that's an absolute dream.
Yeah, it's a total dream. And you know, it's very much about, you know, in our first year, one of the sort of things that we talked about at the National Theatre before we came up with the phrase Theatre Without Walls was the thing we called it Your National Theatre. Mm. And of course, for me, that was a really clear manifesto, which was about going out into Scotland, trying to find the widest possible community of people to engage with different kinds of work. It wasn't trying to find one thing that would engage with everybody, but that you could find a more experimental, weird European theatre piece to engage with a certain group of people in Glasgow. Then you could find a big populist piece to fill out a kind of 2,000 seaters around, and all those things could coexist. But it was about how. So for me, it was very much about how was I going to set up a national theatre that had nothing, that within a certain amount of years the country would be able to claim as their own and have had some kind of relationship with in the different layers, and that was the kind of
and have that kind of that repository for national pride. Or
yeah,
that thing
exactly.
That we're like, this is what
that's
this
exactly
is who we
right.
Are.
And you know, it's really interesting when people talk about. You know, the Irish National Theatre, which is now over 100 years old, isn't it? I don't know exactly how old it is, the Abbey. Mm. And, you know, that's the oldest of the UK islands' national theatres.
Yeah, I never realised that.
And, of course, when you think about plays like all the OKC and the Yates and Singed and everything like that, the reason they've become so well-known by us is because they came from that national theatre that have then put them on and on again, so they have become sort of national icons, those plays. So that was the responsibility of that theatre. Then I think the National Theatre of Scotland has got a different responsibility. I think it is about harvesting the stories of now and pushing theatre forward for now.
So I have many questions now, none of which are the ones I intended to ask, but they're more interesting. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, because I find... I feel like I deal with people or I meet people who are in two camps. The camp of people that go, it's just plays. And the camp of people that go, no, this is important. And for me, and please tell me I'm an idiot, but for me, like, theatre, even though it is this esoteric, theoretically, the people keep telling us it's dying medium. I don't think I agree with it, but anyway, it's really important because for me society is built of the stories we tell, and our identity, like, and every time you tell a story you add a thread to that tapestry. It changes. Were you aware in choosing those stories at NTS and now actually here, because the court has such an impact, that you are sculpting who we are?
No, I don't think I would ever think that. I don't think that I have that much power or ability. What I do believe fundamentally, and agree with you though, is that we are changed by the stories that we tell. Sometimes they can affirm who we are, and sometimes they can shift. That's the other ones I like the most. Who we think we are. But they are vital to us in every way. And I think that one of the things that really thrills me about theatre, and why there is no risk to it in any way at all other than kind of funding, is that, you know, if you look back to sort of ancient Greece, where, you know, you could say that theatre as we recognise it sort of formally first started, whether or not it does, the form of that has not changed. What still happens is an actor walks out in front of an audience and speaks and tells a story. And we laugh at that, we cry about it, we feel connection to it, we are provoked by it, we reject it. In over 2,000 years, theatre hasn't actually changed. So technology and all the things that we've been scared of in theatre, you know, cinema is going to ruin theatre, etc., actually have just helped us tell those stories in different ways. But the actual fundamental act of it is so in our DNA that it really hasn't changed. I find that unbelievably thrilling. And so for me, the other thing I think that is extraordinary about theatre is the fact that we sit in a space together and we witness this event, and the shared witnessing and the empathy that we feel is something that becomes undeniable for us. I think it is the shared witnessing. I sit next to you in this person and I feel something and you felt it too, and I'm always really interested by the fact that, you know, physiologically that feeling of empathy that we get actually does make a change. We can never not have that feeling again, even if it's recreated. So I do believe theatre has the ability to transform. I don't mean to kind of, you know, end the refugee crisis in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, to make us feel something different than we felt before, and then possibly
that might change how we think and then act, and then,
how we speak, and all those kinds of things. And I really believe that is possible. So therefore, I'm in the camp where I think theatre is incredibly, incredibly important to us socially and culturally, as humans and psychologically. And I therefore feel that the kind of seeking of those stories and the people who tell those stories is a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
And that has to be a very active thing.
Because you're curating those changes.
You're curating those moments. And this, and for me, I always feel that I always feel very insecure when we start to program. Even though I'm very confident about the individual bits, I sort of said, oh, but if we put that on now, does that mean that we're missing on that thing that I would like us to be thinking about, or that we are thinking about because the news is telling us about it, or our lives are telling us about it? So for me, it's a very restless act, the thing that I do, which is constantly having to weigh up my power and responsibility to the stories that we should and shouldn't be telling and the people in front of us. That's quite tiring. You know, that's quite wearing.
Yeah.
That's the hardest bit of my job, by the way.
Tell me more about that.
Well, apart from the kind of HR and looking after people, that's absolutely the hardest bit of my job, because it's like a sort of infernal wheel, if you like, of questioning.
Is that the thing?
And although individually you can know that a piece of play is that feels like it's absolutely the right thing to put on, I'm constantly thinking about, well, what's the impact of that over a year, and what does that mean if we haven't been able to get that kind of audience back into the theatre because they started to hear that story and they started to think about that. So there's a lot of that going on.
Because it's also not just the stories you're telling or how you're telling them, it's the things you're not saying.
It's all of that, exactly. It's exactly, you know. And for example, an interesting thing for me was as soon as the hell of Brexit happened on June 24th, that's my wedding anniversary, that's why I remember that. And I got married in France. So it's now like become this deeply tragic thing.
I'm sorry, I should have laughed, but that's awful.
It's terrible. When that happened, it was just very interesting how many people immediately, as a kind of knee-jerk response, totally understandably, contacted me and said, what's the Royal Court doing about Brexit? Because we needed someone, something to help us think about
to hold
this.
That.
Yeah, to hold that. Of course, there isn't anything, because it's still too complicated. So it's interesting that at the moment there is nothing about that, because nobody knows what it would be other than confusion and something. It's just interesting. So that's a conscious thing about not doing anything about that, because all the writers are like, well, I don't know what to think about it. I can't be a spokesperson or a showman about this thing yet. I don't know what it is.
And anything that is clear is a lie just now. Like,
totally.
Just now.
Yeah, and you could do something verbatim and rapid response, but that's been so covered in the news.
Yeah.
I'm always thinking about
it's not adding anything.
No, and I'm always thinking, you know, in the end, what my job is about is a tiny bit of curating, but really what my job is about is giving the platform to the artists and the playwrights, and it's about what they want to write now. And sometimes, you know, like when we, you know, well, I'm trying to think, like when we did Blackwatch a long time ago at the National Theatre of Scotland.
Not that long.
No, 10 years, not that long.
Well, I mean, I remember it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I just don't want to keep harping on it, you know, it's that thing, this thing we don't, you know. But that's an example of me going, actually, we need to be looking at that, and then asking Greg Burke to do that. But the majority of the work, actually, the majority of my level of programming is at the mercy of what the writers that I'm in contact with and commissioning want to write. So it's very much reliant on their awareness of the world and what they think is important. And I find that quite exciting. Yeah. But that's the bit that's quite scary too.
Because who knows?
Yeah.
Do you ever commission based on a thing? Do you ever go, I want to play about...
Well, at the National Theatre of Scotland, I did that a lot more. We did that a lot more, just because it's not a new writing theatre.
Yeah.
So really, it's about creating a programme of work over... I would always try and look at our programme as a year's worth of programming at once, in order that people weren't going within 3 months, well, there's nothing of so-and-so and so-and-so. We go, well, the narrative is over a year.
Yeah.
And it was much easier there to go, are we thinking about this? Are we thinking about that? Are we thinking about that? And to be able to bring different groups of artists together to kind of uncover that in non-narrative ways, which is a lot of dance, lots of different kind of things like that. So yes, I've done a lot of that and I really like it. At the Royal Court, it's like with the Enquirer project we did, with the newspaper project. But the Royal Court, it's slightly harder to do that because basically what you don't want to be doing is sort of television commissioning writers by saying, you know, the commissioning editor has decided that we now need pieces about, you know, police women in the north of England. So where are they? And also, I often feel that that sort of thinking can be incredibly limiting, and not, well, look at the television programme as an example, and not open up possibilities that you hadn't yet imagined. So it's a kind of balance for me about who are we asking at any one time, not what we're asking of them, but who are we asking and what do we know that they're going to bring. So it's the sort of people becomes the balance rather than just the subject that I would ask them to do, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely, because also there's that sense that I always feel like I'm much better in collaboration because other people are interesting.
Totally.
And I think it's almost like tapping into a hive mind, rather than just having to, to bear the responsibility for
absolutely, a
singular vision too much.
And also, you know, I mean, it's interesting when we get sort of waves of plays in certain issues or certain subjects or certain forms and how people sort of affect each other from one thing or what you feels like a sort of, I hate this word, but what you feels like a zeitgeist idea is. And often the best plays are ones that aren't part of that but do something much bigger and other. So an example of that for me in the year that we're, the calendar year that we're in would be like, you know, who knew that we wanted to have a play set in space about not being able to get back to Earth? You know, who knew that that was going to be an amazing play? And who knew that we wanted to have a play about four women sitting in a garden drinking cups of tea and just having a chat and not even doing anything? You know, those are the moments where we get sort of the sort of with those genius minds where they uncover something, and then those plays are about everything that we think about. Loneliness, connection, the end of the world, climate change, you know, but they're not, neither of them set out to write a climate change play, but both of those plays are about how we've fucked up our world and how do we survive as ordinary people within it. But they're also, also hugely, both of those plays, interestingly, about sort of family relationships, you know, mother-daughter relationship in X, all this family relationships of the four women that they talk about, you know, killing a husband, all this kind of thing. You know, who thought I wanted plays about family relationships either?
And all of that complexity. And had you said, I want to play about family relationships, it wouldn't also be about climate change and.
That's exactly it. That's entirely it. So, you know, the thing for me is about these brilliant writers just doing their thing and then us being able to benefit from that, really.
What do you think about what your artistic legacy might be? And I don't mean in a wanky way, I will leave this behind.
No.
Like, do you think about how you, because you create ripples, you seem to be very good at creating like ripples that fill the ecology. Do you think about what they will be in 20, 30, 40 years time when Vicky Featherston has passed from this place?
Yeah, I'm not going anywhere. No. I think that very generous that you say that about ripples, because that is something I believe very strongly in, and that would be a word that I would use.
Oh, good.
Which is about, you know, is what we're doing creating enough ripples? And that's not, ripples is a really important word, because it's not a stir. It's the resonance of it, like sound waves, you know. Hopefully the resonance of this shouldn't die. They might get less and less, but they will
but
be
it's
there
always
forever.
There.
And I think about that a lot. And for me, those sort of moments that create those ripples can occur from lots of different things. And those moments are incredibly important to me and really do fuel a lot of the things that I do. So the first sort of professionally paid job I ever had in theatre was on the Regional Theatre Young Director Scheme when I went to West Yorkshire Playhouse when Jude Kelly was there.
Yeah.
And it's just when the building had reopened, the new big building, and she'd been there for sort of a year, and she's quite young. setting it all off. And it was very interesting being somewhere which had to have, and under Jude's kind of guidance politically, had to have an impact in its community. Mm-hmm. So that was a really important thing for me. I learned very quickly that context, the context that the work is made in, is really important. Who is it for? Who does it matter? Who are we trying to encourage? Mm-hmm. So one of the things when I think about legacy is about the relationship with the audience and how our audience is going to be affected long term by something that they've seen. Mm-hmm. And that I would love that the work that I am responsible for, either directing or more importantly, much more importantly, kind of programming as artistic director, that there will be people from the audience that will never forget some of those mm-hmm. things, and it will influence them hugely. And that's really, and that they, I don't need them to tell me about that. That's mm. about a kind of quiet, private thing that has shifted something, and that really excites me, that possibility. It's also about, then the other side of that for me, especially here, interestingly, at the Royal Court, and I've thought about this a lot because, of course, the context of the Royal Court is a little bit greyer than it is in the National Theatre of Scotland. And I found that quite hard because the legacy here is a sort of powerful, the one I inherited, mm-hmm. is a sort of powerful, it's a sort of powerful, important theatrical elite, the legacy here.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the playwrights that have come through yeah. and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, the legacy feels like it's within the industry.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. Yeah, and of course, in Scotland, it felt like it's absolutely about the artists, but it's as much about the audience of Scotland mm-hmm. and then how Scotland, how we're representing Scotland overseas in mm-hmm. its international work. So that context was very clear in terms of our community work and in terms of all of that. When I got here, that felt less clear, and I really struggled with what that context was. And you know, where we're situated is complex to that.
Yeah.
Although it probably wasn't when it started, because it wasn't the West End, mm-hmm. so it was very clear what its context mm-hmm. was at the end of the Bohemian Kings Road.
Yeah.
Now that's different.
So now, yeah, it feels like that the character of the place is very, very different.
Yeah, completely. Although it's useful, I've learned a lot from that, mm. looking at that as a positive, which I didn't think I would learn.
Yeah.
But for me, that context was very complex, and it was about also the question of who am I bringing into the theatre, and we will never be able to encourage all the people to come to this place mm-hmm. that I think should be able to witness our work. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. That's not the right way around. It's not big enough. Mm-hmm. So what is that about taking work out to people and building relationships with communities in a different way? But the big breakthrough for me in terms of the context was, and this is really, really vital in terms of legacy, was realising that although we want as wide a possible audience to witness the work, mm. we want to sell out as much as possible, we want to be kind of successful in all of those ways, the most important thing, I think, about the Royal Court is that we encourage writers to write plays who influence other writers. And it was this thing for me. If we had to take everything else away,
yeah,
which I would never want to do, if we had to take everything else away,
that's the thing.
That would be the thing. Mm. And I think if you look back, the Royal Court is at its best when writers are writing plays here which influence the way other writers then think.
When it's sort of leading a charge.
Yeah, when it's leading a charge. Mm. And you can really see that movement. Yeah. And I'm saying writers because we're talking about the Royal Court, but of course I actually mean theatre makers, yeah. theatre thinkers, all of those things. Yeah. People like the whole of us around. We are writers. But yeah, and I think that's really, really important. And that was quite a thrilling thing mm. to go, I've gone from something which is about a very big, broad national legacy concept, yeah. actually to something which is a bit more of an intellectual idea mm-hmm. as a legacy. And actually that we're not often allowed to admit that mm. Mm. because we often have to speak about the widest possible yeah. and of course for me it's about the widest possible writers, the widest possible group of people having access to all that, but actually it's an intellectual idea about what are the plays that are affecting the other writers mm-hmm. and often the plays that affect the other writers are often the plays that haven't been necessarily the biggest hits to yeah. the public
because they do this tiny brilliant thing
yeah
yeah
and that's And it's really important going back to the idea of stability versus risk, that we don't become over obsessed with stability at the expense of risk, because then we could have some very good plays on that would get really good audiences and might even transfer to the West End and make us some money, but they're not necessarily going to have any lasting impact.
Yeah, nothing would change
on the writers or theatre makers going forward. So I feel this is a real sort of engine.
Yeah, that's a really interesting legacy. It's sort of about lighting the touch paper.
Yeah,
yeah.
And we'll never know. The exciting thing about that is it's not, you know, yeah. I can't follow it. I mean, I can have conversations with people about it, but I won't know.
And that's, yeah, that's brilliant.
Love it that it's not tangible.
Yeah. Who knows what change we elicit as we move through the world.
Yeah.
It's interesting you talked about context. I've been thinking a lot about context recently, because I was looking at, because I studied ancient history and I had a little bit of a thing about ancient Egypt in particular.
Yeah.
And I was in the Met in New York looking at some canopic jars. I'm just going to tell you, I don't know what this is relevant
to. I love it already.
Right. So these canopic jars, and the canopic jars are when you mummify somebody, you take out their internal organs and you put them in these jars so that they can go with them into the afterlife, so that they can have their liver when they get there, but just so that the body won't decay on the journey. And they tend to be made of alabaster, and they're beautiful, or obsidian maybe, and they're beautifully carved, like white with, like, they're just stunning. They're the sort of thing that you would put on your mantelpiece, except it's got someone's heart in it. So you go to a museum, and the British Museum have got them, and the Met have got loads, and they're laid out like these beautiful works of art, which they are. And I just happened to be there behind a troop of tourists from, like, upstate New York, and I was kind of listening to what they were saying, and I knew a little bit about stuff, and I was like, this is really interesting. And I found myself getting really angry, because they were talking about the beauty of these things, and I was like, that's somebody's heart, and that's somebody's lungs, and that, like, the context of those things entirely changes what they are.
Yeah.
And here they are just beauty.
Yeah.
But where they belong, where they're from, they are life itself.
Wow, that's nice.
And I feel like, especially when we make theatre, I think we don't always think enough about context. Mm. Like you were talking about, not everyone can come here to see everything, but maybe not everyone should.
No, I agree, absolutely.
Because the stories, need to exist in their place.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And also, the stories don't. How can we know how to make the stories be or look like they should be able to relate to everybody? We can just do what we are now and who we are, and how the accident of the writers who happen to be writing for the Royal Court now, and what that means. Mm. You know, there's something... I think if you tried to do it as a sort of grid and take that absolute responsibility, it would be a huge failure.
Mm.
So there has to be the accident of chance and voice, and what we miss out because we have something else instead, and all of those kind of things is really important. But that's another thing that makes the whole thing so wearing, because you sort of go, well, I don't want to be too... I can't be mathematical about this or scientific in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be a sort of... I think what I feel my job is about... having the widest possible surface area.
Right. For people to react
with. Yeah, for people to react with. And that, you know, that's me, that's our other associates, that's everyone else in the building. I think for me, one of the really important things is that I'm excited about here, and definitely with the same National Literature Scotland and Haynes Blair, was about enabling and empowering people in the building to feel that they can be part of that search and that conversation, what we should be doing. It's not my sole responsibility, it's my responsibility to sort of be the mother of it, but not to...
To create
actually,
the conditions where that can happen.
That's right, but not to know it all, or to have to get it all, or to find it all.
Do you think that's again, off-piece question, but I feel like that's quite a rare... I talk to quite a lot of artistic leaders, especially now I'm doing this, and I think it's quite rare for people to go, to admit that they don't know everything. There are breeds, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I think that, you know, the big... I mean, Well, you know, if you work in new writing, if you work with living writers, it's a huge relief because you know you cannot, you are not them. They are the ones that are these kind of, you know, these alchemists that live in the world and out of the same experience that I have, literally create a piece of art, which I then interpret.
Yeah.
But they do the alchemy. Mm-hmm. I just put the light on it. Mm-hmm. So how can I know the answers? I can't know the answers because I don't, because they surprise me. Virtually every play I read has that surprise for me. So it's a really important thing to know your place, really, even as artistic director within what the art is that is being made with you and that you're able to make. It's really important to know your place. And I was talking about something the other day about what your ego is in that. Because, of course, traditionally, the ego of theatre artistic directors has been about going, I am this everything here reflects me. It is this. You know, I do classics because you know the classic, so there's no question about that. My ego is imprinted upon the classic, so you see how I've interpreted it.
Yeah.
All of those things. I think that's where we think traditionally that ego lies. My ego is as great as massive as anyone's, and my sense of arrogance. And I don't mean that as in an insecure way.
To function in this world, you have to. Yeah.
That's right. And mine is about a kind of joy and a sense of pride about myself that Carol Churchill sent escaped alone to the Royal Court while I was artistic director. You know, I had nothing to do with that. She still wrote that play, and she would have sent it to any artistic director. But I, you know, for me, that's all I've ever wanted, is to be one of the first people to read a Carol Churchill play. She sends me an email going, would you be interested in reading my play that I've just written? You know, my head exploded when I opened that email.
Yes, I've been dreaming about it since I was about 15.
You know, so there is massive ego in there, but it's not the ego of having to imprint yourself on everything. It's the ego of feeling thrilled that people feel that they are able to excel and reach their potential with you.
Yeah, it's the pride of, like, do you garden at all?
Well, no, because I've got a tiny little yard, but I do buy
so
a lot
you
of plants. I do buy a lot of plants that then die, and then I just replace them with some new plants. But yes, I would, one day when I'm a grown up, I will garden.
Because I was thinking, I started a couple of years ago growing tomatoes in pots.
Yes, I do that.
And, like, it makes me so proud.
I know.
And I don't do anything other than put the seed in the pot and occasionally water it.
No. I mean, I tell you something, right? For me, it's the same as my kids are now 16 and 14, and it's the same for me as if I'm sitting around with some friends and we're having a conversation, and, you know, they'll be part of a discussion that we're having, and they will really surprise me with their views and what they're saying, and I'm like, oh my god, you're extraordinary. And my ego is, but you're my child, but actually I haven't raised you
to be extraordinary.
But of course I haven't. They're whatever they want to be. They are their own thing, and that's what happened. So it's a really similar thing.
Yeah. That's interesting. Do you... I'm going to hate myself for asking this question, but I have to.
I led you into it. I'm sorry. I mentioned motherhood.
Is there a gender thing? I feel like... Look, I feel like the people with the classics...
Yeah.
...imprinting them...
Yeah.
...they tend to be a certain breed of floppy-haired man.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I do. I feel that.
Tell me about that in a minute. Please be erudite on that, because I hate... On the one hand, I feel like... Well, I think on the one hand, I feel like I don't ever want to talk about my gender.
No.
Because fuck that shit.
Yeah.
I can say that because it's my podcast.
Yeah, totally.
But at the same time, there are things that my experience of moving through this world are that make me a lot better at things than people that don't have the same...
Yeah.
battles, because I think if you are a woman, you have to learn to negotiate your way out of shit in a way that men don't.
Yeah,
and you are socialised broadly. I'm going to hate myself for saying this, but like you're socialised broadly. Maybe. you're socialised broadly to like consider the room in a different way, and not all women are socialised like that, but that is the umbrella narrative.
Yeah. It's hard, isn't it? I mean, you know, I think that a lot of the those a lot of those justified generalisations about theatre, people who make theatre, is also could also go is it to do with class and education, and has it taken longer for women to get into that kind of specific kind of educated class to want to pursue those things? I don't know. I think class is a massive thing about that, because I think those, you know, it's not men, they're middle class, upper middle class educated men who are those floppy haired men with those doing the classics.
Yes, that's and better, that's really, and more fair.
But it's, no, but it's interesting. It is. It's a, you know, there's, it's often Oxbridge, it's often, or even if it isn't Oxbridge, it's an aspiration to Oxbridge.
Yeah, it's the desire to appear as a character in Brideshead Revisited.
Yeah, and you know, so yeah, so so people have made it brilliantly, not through that particular pathway, but it is because it's reflecting that pathway and that way of talking about it. I think all that shit, right? Obviously. But and it's not that I don't admire what individuals have, what individuals create or what individuals do. It's just not for me. And I haven't, it's never, ever interested me. What I've always been more interested in is the effect that theatre has, the context of theatre and that we're talking about, and the effect it can have on anybody, rather than having to come to it from through a certain lens. And that's always just excited me. I think that's excited me because of who I am, not necessarily my gender, who I am politically, and I think that would, but it's very hard to split those two things
it's all
up.
Informed,
But I feel that the job of artistic director, which is that balance between chief executive, so take responsibility for the whole of the running business, HR, all of that side of the organisation, business planning, and then taking responsibility for the artistic side of the organisation as well, which is quite an unusual job, and some people would never go for that job, and some people love that job, like I love that those two things. I feel that the sort of I think that the sort of multitasking nature of that, and the nurturing versus ambition, all those things, which in order to have a happy place to be able to do that in, I think they are more female-minded attributes that you need to bring to it. Whether that, I don't know, I'm not saying that's necessarily gender, but it's definitely the approach of that. And I feel that the women that I know who are artistic directors or have been artistic directors in my generation actually manage that often a lot better than the men that I know who are artistic directors of that of our generation. I mean, personally. I don't mean as in what it looks to the outside world. I just mean as in where the stress levels are and where the crises hit and all those kind of things. Because I think that a lot of the brilliant male artistic directors who I know have had huge successes have actually found some of those things quite difficult to kind of coexist, whereas I feel that women I know are better designed for that particular weird job. It's a weird job. I mean, it's an odd thing.
Yeah, managing like the pragmatic and the ephemeral.
Yeah, it's all that.
Yeah.
It is that. So, you know, that's a terrible generalisation. But, you know, if somebody wanted to pin me to a wall with a gun to my head and I had to list them, I would be able to. Who it's as much about how, what I'm talking about is as much about how one privately manages those two things as an artistic director, not necessarily, I'm repeating myself, sorry, but not necessarily how it looks to the outside world.
Yeah, that's interesting, because now that's got me thinking, I mean, this is a whole nother, this is a different podcast, but yeah, just thinking about that sense of how much of yourself you give and how bruised you you allow yourself, like, and just managing that.
I mean, I give absolutely all of myself, but I give it in a way which is whole to the rest of my life. So I started at Payne's Plough when I was 28, and I'm now 49. So I've been an artistic director and a chief executive, literally without a break, since I was 28. Yeah, 21 years.
Wow.
And then I had my first child when I was 30. So, 31. So what's interesting for me is that I've only ever done this job with family, really, these jobs with family. So the way for me personally to make these jobs work are that it is all of me that is part of the job, and I don't think I could do this job without that, because I think that's the thing that keeps all of those different plate spinning for me, and allows that sort of multitasking to take place. I don't feel I need to come in. I don't feel I have to come into work and be a certain kind of person here.
You are yourself.
I am.
Wherever you
I've
are.
Been able, and I know that is because actually, and again, this is just my own particular circumstance. Not that I think I should, anyone should do it like this. It's because having had this job always with children and for a long time with young children, I haven't been able to do it any other way than being fully myself, because I haven't been able to pretend it.
Yeah.
And I think that's been a real saving grace. I'd have gone mad otherwise. If I'd have had to do this on my own, without having to bring my family into all of this, I don't know how I would have balanced it out. Some nights would have been easy because I could have stayed later and not had to go home and done a bit more work, but that's it.
Because I think that's one of the things, because I'm 34 and I got my job. Doesn't feel like it. And I got my job at Oval House when I was 28 or 29, which is a similar thing.
Yeah.
And I haven't had children because I am so frightened of the weight of guilt that I bear for everything already in my life being not quite done as I would wish.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I'm either going to get over it or I'm not. But I feel like that's an amazing, in a way, that's, had I had my first kid just as I started Oval House, I'd have learned to be like that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Which is a really useful thing.
Yeah. And I also think, I think that's right. And I think the other thing is, you know, oh my God, they're legacy. The other thing I think is that you don't know any better. It can't be any other way. So one of the things is you don't have to, you know, I mean, none of it was planned, it just kind of happened for me. So you just sort of get on with it. And actually that's quite good.
Yeah, just get on with life.
But you don't overthink it, do you? Just go, oh my God, I'm pregnant, right, that's it. So now we get on to the next thing, that means.
My mum says this, I'm the youngest of five, and she says that if she'd had access to the kind of contraception we have now, she never would have been able to choose to have children.
Yeah. That's exactly the same.
And I can so sympathise. Yeah.
I mean, also, because I've never been somebody... I always imagined I would have children, but I've never been somebody saying, oh, my God, I want to have children, I want to have children at all. So I don't know whether I would now be at 49 going, oh, my God, it didn't happen, if it hadn't happened by mistake.
Yeah.
Because I don't think the time would ever have felt right.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, isn't it? It's an interesting thing about once we start to over-plan in society and work in the world. I talk about this a lot with young directors, a lot with young women, about, you know, now there are a lot, the pathways, the possibilities seem better, much better than they were when I was starting out. You can connect up with other people who are in the same position as you. There's big groups of people all going through the same thing.
But you have to choose, like, unequivocally so much.
Yeah, it's much harder because of all of that. And I think the sort of oblivion and just getting on with it actually can be quite a relief in comparison.
And actually, that's reflected almost in the rehearsal room, isn't it? That sometimes when you rock up without a plan because you don't quite know what the right question is even, then you can find the way in an interesting way.
Yeah. I don't so much anymore because now obviously I'm grown up. But when I was younger, there would always be, you know, like one day in the rehearsal room where we'd all have gone out and had much too much to drink the night before, and everyone would turn up with kind of terrible hangovers and you'd have to kind of survive the way through the day. And I would often find that that was the day when I had my best discovery.
Yeah.
Because you went into a different thing and you had to sort of go, you know, and you'd find something else.
Yeah, and you're willing to try anything that will mean it's less agonising for just 10 minutes.
Yeah, and you go into a different headspace. Quite interesting, not to be recommended, obviously.
God forbid.
The alcoholic director. I'm not saying that.
No, but maybe the questioning open director. Let's just phrase it like that. Right?
Yeah, perfect. Anyway, I had a great night in the pub the night before.
And that's really important. That's part of the process.
Totally.
Okay, so I think my last question then is, why do you do this?
Gosh, that's a brilliantly difficult question, and also very easy. It's hard to answer that without sounding pat, because, you know, my sort of immediate answer is I can't imagine doing anything else, apart from being a nurse, because my mum was a nurse, and I always wanted to be a nurse. I can't imagine doing anything else. What I love about it is that there are so many aspects to it, so it keeps me really interested and excited and challenged all the time. So all of those different things, even though I often whinge about how that there are too many of them. but all those different aspects of it. And I sort of think that I do it because I came to the sort of growing realisation that, you know, you start off with one thing and you're interested in one thing when you're a kid, and then that leads on to another thing, another thing. It's like a sort of rolling stone in a way. You sort of end up going, oh, all of these things add up. Oh, my God, there is a job. You know, when I was... the first thing I ever did work-wise when I was 9, very precociously, I used to love reading, and I lived in Purley. And I used to go to my local library, and they still existed. It was a big children's library. I always love it there. And then I once went up to the woman and I said, can I come and work here on a Saturday, putting the books away? And she said, yes. So I worked for a year, and I got 10p a Saturday. And I worked for a year in the little Purley children's library. And it was like one of the most exciting things I ever did, because I would put all the books in alphabetical order, and then I would literally then get to do the little tickets and stamp the tickets and this kind of thing.
The power of that.
I know. I mean, I just absolutely loved it. But, you know, there's still something about that which is still in this job. You know?
Yeah.
So for me, it's the curation and the order. So, you know, and the plays and the... So there's just something about, you know, when you're lucky enough to end up with a job which feels like it's all the things that you have been sort of paddling around in lots of different ways, then that's kind of amazing, really.
Yeah.
Because there's inevitability to it.
Yeah.
And I never imagined it, that I'd get it, so...
You just are. It's what you are, I think.
It's what you are.
Yeah, that kind of happens.
It's amazing, isn't that, with people, though? Mm. You just sort of look at them and you go, wow, the, you know, I don't know.
What else would you... Yeah, what else could you be?
Yeah, or what else... Yeah, one is the sum of everything.
Yeah.
Fascinates me.
There's a Louis de Bernier poem that people read at weddings about roots growing intertwined and stuff. And I always think about that in terms of, like, in terms of theatre. Like, I don't remember a time when one of the things I did wasn't somehow this.
Yeah, no, exactly the same. It's weird, isn't it? And I think it's also weird about how you... I'm really fascinated. I think this about a lot now. You know, sometimes about, like, how do people become playwrights? What's the thing that... means that they sit down one day and start writing
other people's words.
Other people's words like that. Yeah. Rather than writing a poem, or rather than not writing, or rather than... Isn't it amazing that we just kind of end up doing these, or someone picks up a guitar and they will write a song?
Yeah.
Or I find that utterly and utterly fascinating about what is it in our individual DNA that... guides us into these different things.
Because music I understand much more in a way than playwriting, because I studied singing and trained as a singer for a long time.
My God, you're and so inspiring, so many amazing things.
Or a dilettante, depending on how you look at it. Maybe I should stick at something.
No, I don't.
And yet, like, I understand why people like sing, because that expresses something you cannot express in any other way.
Yeah,
I know what that's for. I can't do it any other way. But like writing a play... Like the, I, but that's why I could don't do it.
Yeah.
Because I don't understand that imperative.
Yeah. But also, sometimes, you know, it's people sort of, you know, it's an interesting thing about age, because, you know, you never want to be ageist at all, and you want to kind of be able to encourage people. But there is a part of me where I sort of go, well, if you've got to 40 and you haven't written a play, you're probably not a playwright. It doesn't mean to say that if you wrote a brilliant play, I wouldn't put it on.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, some people wake up and it's all that they know that they can do. And I love it that people shift around and do different things and swap jobs, all those things. But, you know, I'm 49, I haven't written a play.
Yeah.
There is a reason for that. It's because I am not a playwright.
My dad used to say that. He's a potter. And he's like, if you don't have to do it by the time you're 30, you probably just shouldn't.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
That'll make a lot of people feel really scared that you can say that. All these people are going, oh, I haven't done it.
No, but you can have to do it without having got there.
Yes, like,
you
that's
can
very
have
true.
The urge.
I think that's right, though.
I think the urge is there.
I do think that's absolutely right. I think that's right. The other thing that has happened in our society, which is the legacy of people paying for education and different things, is that there are a lot more courses available to people, which I think are incredibly distracting. Because what happens is that, you know, you had to pitch into Oval House at the age that you did. I started a Payne's Plan. That age now, which isn't that long ago for you, but people of that age now, 27 or 28, are going, oh, I don't know if I'm ready to run an organisation yet. I think I need to go and... Can I come and shadow you, Vicky, in a thing?
Peter Hall ran the arts at 23.
Yeah, no, but this is the legacy of and it is because there are more courses offered and more resource put into that kind of thing. So we all think that we can get a little bit more training to be better at the thing when we get there, rather than just doing it. And that's been a massive shift for us.
Whereas actually nothing prepares you.
No, just do it.
Just do it, make
someone
a mess of it.
Someone said to me the other day, a really brilliant woman, she's like a sort of producer for a big company, but the producers and the creators, really interesting work. And she came to me because she wants to change to be a director. And I just thought, well, why don't you just direct something? And she was like, oh. And I didn't mean that glibly. It was like, you know, if you want to be a director, get a group of people together. You don't need any money. You need money to put shows on properly.
Yeah.
But if you want to be a director, you just need to get a group of students together who want to try and be in a play.
And give it a go.
Give it a go.
Although I can sympathise. I've just... I'm making a show as a solo theatre maker for the first time. I've just spent 5 years. I now realise being a complete shit to theatre makers by saying things like, just get on with it. I'm making a show because I think I have to. And I've got a bit of Arts Council funding, and I got an artist that I really trust to come in and work with me. And I was a bit upset about a thing, and she's like, well, that's the show that you have to make, that's why you're upset. And I was like, yeah, but... And she's like, well, just get on with it. And so it's
exactly
quoted
right.
me back to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I was evil. But I understand the fear or the...
Yes.
Of the new thing.
Yeah, well, do you know what? This is so interesting, I just get on with it. Because this is something I learned from Jude Kelly, right? So there I was like 23, regional theatre young director scheme, went to live in Leeds, got my granddad's Ford Fiesta, which he lent me, packed the car, drove up, didn't know anywhere to live, turned up there, really excited. And started assisting, doing various things, met gorgeous people, found somewhere to live. It was like one of those, like, you know, amazing experiences that you just, everything shifts as a result of it. And one of the things that Jude said to me, which is, I'm too busy, I will not be able to give you the time that I should give you, and I know I'm going to feel guilty about that, so I just have to tell you that, you know, I am running the West Yorkshire Playhouse, it's massive, I've got small children, there's a whole set of conversations I would love to have with you that we will never have, maybe one day, but I'm just telling you that up front. And I really admired her for that.
Yeah.
When we see each other now, we really laugh about that. And I'm like, it was just very clear. She says, the one thing I will tell you is you're here because I believe in you, because I went through an interview process. You're here because I believe in you. So I'm giving you carte blanche, basically. She said, any idea that you have, she said, run it by me. But then, and when I say, yes, I like the idea, you do not need to come back to me for me to make it happen to you. You have to do it yourself. And she said, that's basically the thing. And I was like, God, that's so
That's liberating. A dream come true.
It's so liberating.
Yeah.
Because you just sort of go, all right, here, we've got a theatre now. You know, so we created a youth theatre project. We created comedy improvisation. I raised £80,000 for a street theatre festival from Leeds City Council in the centre of Leeds to try and repopulate it over 4 years. All this stuff. But it was just because she just went, well, just do it.
Just do it. Yeah.
That's great. Such a learning thing.
I wish more people said that now.
I know.
I feel like that doesn't get...
I do say it a lot. But that's definitely her legacy to me, and then that passes on, and that's that thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
We just did this, like, the open court thing with the young people, you know, and we sort of went, let's do it, and then we come to me, should we do this? And we go, I've said we're doing open court with young people. You know, it's not mine.
I just don't want it to be my problem.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then my ego, going back to ego, is the fact that, you know, I was, that happened. My ego isn't any responsibility for any of the work that happened, which is amazing, because they just did it themselves.
But that in itself, though, that ability to go, I trust, is so deeply rare. Not many people do that. And again, there's probably a correlation with the kind of theatre you make and your class and all that stuff. But the understanding that sometimes control can come in giving up control.
Yeah, definitely.
It's special.
That's right.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.